scary device.
Yeah, don't put it too close to anybody.
Yeah. Well, welcome everybody. It's nice to see a healthy turnout on a February evening. But we're about halfway between Groundhog Day and Valentine's Day, so this is what's happening.
On a Friday night.
Yeah, hot time in the old town. So we've invited Lama Sonam and Lama Yangchen to come up and visit. And Lama Sonam will be talking about introducing Tibetan Buddhism and talking about green Tara and maybe other Taras, and a little bit perhaps about the Heart Sutra. And so I think we'll have a fairly informal, open discussion at some point. Lama Sonam will let you know when questions are appropriate. But I heard the door, but I think let's go ahead and get started. It is kind of warm in here, but is everybody okay? What?
You can prop that door open, it helps.
Should we?
No.
Okay, a no from Jim, okay. Well,
with no further ado, Lama Sonam. Oh, I was going to say that it's been over 25 years since I met Lama Sonam and Yangchen. It was the end of 1989 when they just got out of their retreat for their 3 year plus retreat for being becoming lamas down in Markola. So, anyway, welcome.
Thank you. I'm going to start with a Tibetan prayer. That's a pretty standardized prayer that all the lineages from Tibet say. It's a kind of a condensed refuge in bodhicitta prayer, refuge in generating the mind of awakening, the altruistic heart, bodhicitta, as a reminder to ourselves when we begin any endeavor that we try to have the proper motivation, that we're embarking on this activity, in this case, the journey to awakening for the benefit of all limitless sentient beings. And so we can try to keep that in mind as we do teaching or meditation. So anyway, as Lynn said, an introduction to Tibetan Buddhism, a little bit on the Heart Sutra, and a little discussion about Tara practice. So we've got about, 2,000 years of material. So in my note, I have it, keep it practical, stupid. and not be overly historical and bogged down with detail. So there's a slogan in Mahayana Buddhism that says, all Dharma can be condensed into one point or one purpose, and that is the eradication of self-clinging, and thereby revealing one's inner Buddha nature. So the meaning of Buddha actually in Tibetan is Sangye, and the first syllable refers to Sang, clearing away veils, obscurations, and then the Ge is the flourishing or revealing what is already there. It's not created, it's not produced, and that's the Tathagatagarbha or the Buddha nature. So that's the meaning of the word Buddha. So when we think of our practice, that's the process that's taken place. So when the, we all know the story of the historic Buddha Shakyamuni, right? So, it's important to point out that Tibetan Buddhism is not, the Tibetans kind of take offense at that term. It's not, they don't believe it's their Buddhism, or that they created it there. They received it from India, and they kind of became the stewards of Buddhism when it was flourishing in India, especially in the, like around the 10th century. Like at famous universities, Nalanda University, which were like the centers of amazing ecumenical learnings. And then it was from that, during that era, that it mainly was imported to Tibet. So, basically, we could say that if we think of the Dharma coming to that one purpose, the eradication of the belief in a self, all of the teachings, however you sum them up, or whatever categories they're put into, like the three baskets, the Tripitaka, which are divided up into ethics, meditation, and wisdom. Again, it's for that same purpose. So the teachings on ethics provide a foundation to allow oneself to be able to do meditation or let the mind rest in the natural state without too much interference from inner turmoil. There's an old saying from John Adams that says, all sober inquirers of the truth know that virtue leads to happiness. So, if we are attempting to explore the nature of our minds through meditation, first of all, we have to understand the principles of non-aggression and refrain from harming others and ourselves. And this is generalized or summed up in the basic Hinayana training of what they call the outer training of proper conduct of body and speech. And then, so at least outwardly, we're behaving in good manners. And then inwardly, our motivation is to refrain, not only refrain from harming ourselves and others, but to cultivate beneficial behavior. So anyway, with this as our foundation, then we begin with the meditation practice. So meditation is summed up as, or can be included as, calm abiding and special insight, or shamatha vipassana, or shinaya latam. The benefits of meditation are inconceivable. But we begin with basic sitting practice. And that is called calm abiding. As we allow ourselves to sit and let the mind be without dwelling on the past or the future, but in the immediate present, we are advised to just gently observe whatever occurs without overreacting. So thoughts and emotions come up, and we are non-judgmental, and regarding the thoughts and emotions like waves in the water. And in time, by repeatedly doing this process, the belief in their inherent power becomes neutralized, or we start to disengage from the drama of thoughts and emotions. And there begins to be a lighter touch on things. And the what's called a gap refers to a gap between one thought and the next, starts to expand. And so we experience what is known as non-distracted awareness. We've all experienced it. There's the one breath meditation, where you can actually, before the thoughts come back. Anyway, this non-distraction can start to increase. So in the beginning, we're usually, if we do a meditation session, quite honestly, if we say we do a 10-minute session, maybe 8 minutes are our mind's pretty much out of control. Maybe there's 2 minutes of awareness that's clear and pristine. So, but just being aware of that is the first step. And then in time, that non-distraction starts to increase, the gap starts to increase. And here, non-distraction doesn't mean no thought, per se. That's often misunderstood. Non-conceptual awareness comes as a byproduct. There can be thoughts. The important thing is to sustain non-distraction, or to be aware of what's happening moment to moment. This is all part of calm abiding practice. Shine in Tibetan, shamatha in Sanskrit. It's the foundation of all meditation. And as a result, there might be some pliancy, what they call pliancy or suppleness of mind. It's like exercising, when you loosen up your muscles, yet the mind, which can be called the subtlest of instruments, starts to become more supple. These are some of the hallmarks of proper calm abiding practice. As the mind becomes more supple, one can apply that skill to anything. So it's a valuable tool for any activity that one engages in. But in the Dharma and in Buddhism, you want to apply that skill specifically for something that is more ultimate, more profound. You apply that pliancy skill to vipassana or latong, seeing further is what it calls, going beyond. And we can't apply proper vipassana without that ability of shamatha as a foundation. Because the ripples of the surface of the lake have to calm down before you can see the reflection of the moon in water. That's the analogy that they often give. So we let the mind calm down, and then with that clarity, spaciousness, we start to explore the nature of the mind, the nature of the thoughts. Before that, we just disengage, basically, disengage thoughts, disengage emotions. But in Vipassana, you start to explore, and this is the meaning of Prajnaparamita. When we get to that level, the Prajnaparamita means the perfection of wisdom, transcendental wisdom. And so the these practices up to now are pretty common to all the schools of Buddhism.
And that's the Heart Sutra.
Well, no, not yet. I mean, that leads, the meaning of the Heart Sutra is the Vipassana, basically.
Okay.
Yeah, the perfection of wisdom. So if we were to do a session, you know, if you were doing a meditation session, proper beginning, proper middle, proper conclusion is emphasized to make it genuine, or to make sure we don't go astray. So the proper beginning is we go for refuge and generate the mind of awakening. Refuge is said to be the door of liberation. When we go for refuge, if we have the warm heart of the Bodhisattva, we're going for refuge on behalf of all limitless sentient beings, and we in truth want to become a source of refuge. We want to be able to truly help people, not just temporarily help. So there are known, sometimes it's summarized as outer refuge and inner refuge. So we begin by emphasizing the outer refuge. In this case, it has to be a refuge that's unconditional, something that's not subject to the push and pull of, emotions, or free of fear. So the three jewels, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, symbolize that. And so in the beginning, we take, like in the Hinayana, we would take refuge in the Buddha, historic Buddha, as an example, and the Dharma as the path, and the Sangha as the community or guides that guide us along. In the beginning, the Dharma is the most important. It's emphasized because all the Buddhas times cannot save us. So that's an important emphasis, that refuge is not considered to be, or the objects of refuge are not considered saviors. We have to apply our own effort. And so that's where the Dharma comes in. That's the medicine that we have to take ourselves. And so the Dharma is called the insurpassable protection. Eventually we become, through our experience and journey on the path, we become able to be sources of refuge. So there's a prayer also, there are many varieties of refuge prayer, but there's one prayer where it concludes by saying, I take refuge also in the mind itself, clear and empty Dharmakaya. So, okay, we say the refuge prayer, like the verse I just said at the beginning, and then we generate the brave mind of awakening, the bodhisattva, warm-hearted, altruistic motivation, and then we begin whatever practice we're doing. And then as we do the practice, we try to be free of any fixation or solidity in our practice. So we understand that the subject, object, and the action are like a dream, like an illusion, free of inherent existence. So in Chine, so we take that, that's kind of like a Mahamudra spirit, or the ultimate view spirit in whatever practice we're doing. So if we were doing Shine, then we would begin sitting and just sitting naturally and cultivating methods or non-methods to generate that non-distracted awareness. And then from there, perhaps go into Vipassana. And so, if we refer to the Heart Sutra, which is the essence of the Prajnaparamita, it is said to be the transcendental perfection of wisdom, and or the paramita, Prajnaparamita. Paramita means crossing over. Crossing over to the other shore. So there's a sense of a journey. Crossing over the shore of confusion to the liberating banks of nirvana, if you want to call it that. So what's interesting is in the Heart Sutra, it goes further than that in the sense that it starts to say the whole journey was an illusion. And there really is no going from point A to point B. And that's why, according to the story, some people got upset when they heard the Heart Sutra. When the teachings took place on Vulture Peak in India, and the story goes the Buddha was in Samadhi, and then there was one of the great bodhisattvas, Avalokiteshvara, and Shariputra. And then Shariputra posed the question to Avalokiteshvara, how does a bodhisattva actually rest the mind in wisdom? And so through the power of the awakened one, Avalokiteshvara was inspired to speak. So he spoke the sutra. And, I'm not sure how many are familiar with the sutra, but it's interesting to note, and this was pointed out in a commentary, that it was Avalokiteshvara who spoke the sutra, not the Buddha. And Avalokiteshvara is like the a symbol or embodiment of compassion. So, yet the sutra itself, if you take it at face value, is basically a bunch of negation. So he'll say that, you know, that the five skandhas, the psychophysical makeup of the sentient being, form, feeling, discernment, formation, and consciousness, are recognized to be empty of inherent existence. That's how it begins. And then he starts to go through this catalog of no eyes, no ears, no nose, and a lot of no's. And it's like a, sometimes it's called a deconstruction sutra. And if you were just to intellectually read it without a commentary, it would be kind of strange. It sounds nihilistic, but that you really need a guide, a teacher to guide you through this sutra. And in a way, it's like a koan, a Japanese koan, a riddle. It's said that the ideal person who's ready to hear teachings on emptiness, the wisdom of emptiness, is one where they get goosebumps and they start crying when they hear the teachings on emptiness. So it's like they're ripe. Actually, the emptiness should trigger a heartfelt response, not just a head trip. And that's the ideal person. So you think, okay, why would that be? Why would a bunch of negation cause one to cry? Because if it's done properly, it leads to a discovery of total selflessness. And correct selflessness is a beautiful, wonderful thing, as we've all had glimpses of that. And so it's the union of compassion and wisdom taking place when it's done properly. And we're often reminded that, okay, are we doing this properly? If you made this a regular practice, then you have to gauge it by how much compassion one has, how much heartfelt altruism one has. Then one knows one's doing it right. If it becomes drier and drier and more intellectual, then obviously we need to do some adjustment. There's a Tibetan saying that the journey from the head to the heart is the longest journey. So as if one were to recite the Heart Sutra every day or as a regular practice, it's the same as doing a Vipassana meditation. And you start by doing contemplation or analytical meditation. So as you say, for example, that the skandhas are empty and no eyes, no ears, the chanter uses it as a contemplation. So as soon as he says no eyes, the sense faculty of the eyes is disengaged. Or it's a prelude to disengaging. And it doesn't mean that the eyes don't exist. That's a misnomer. That the ears don't exist. They relatively, of course, we operate and exist. But autonomously or independently, there's nothing there in and of itself. It's like a dream. It's like we're dreaming that we are here existing, but it's no different from a dream. When we really analyze it and break it down in analytical meditation, if you were to use that technique, then you can't find anything. It's unfindable. There's no findable essence that's independent of anything. So that's what's meant here. And depending on the school of Tibetan Buddhism, there would be different approaches to that. But the point is, even in Chine, in Shamatha, before we do these, if you let the mind be naturally in the present, fully present moment, this sense faculties start to disengage. And it doesn't mean they're shut, they're suppressed or closed. In fact, we're encouraged to keep them open. But the consciousness, which flirts around, flits around, ends up in the more fundamental nature of what's known as the ground consciousness, or very close to Buddha nature. Different words they have for it. So this is what's being referred to when we do the no eyes, no ears, no nose and stuff as well. But again, we're pointing out that ultimately there is no arising or no cessation in all of these sense faculties, sense objects. And even it gets down to the point where even the Four Noble Truths, truth of suffering, truth of cause of suffering, truth of cessation and the path, that those also don't exist. And there's no attainment, no non-attainment, so forth. And then finally it builds up to the mantra. And this is a sutra, and sutras, usually when you think of mantras, we think of the tantras of the Vajrayana practices. But some sutras have mantras as well. And the mantra here, the gate mantra, paragate, gate gate paragate parasam. So it finally concludes with the mantra, and the mantra is like the breakthrough. That symbolizes the breakthrough into seeing further, seeing beyond. And so here, all time-space continuum is broken asunder. So up until now, if we really think about it, everything that was described is based on relative linear point A to point B reference points. So it's a helping aid to experience the true nature of mind and phenomena. And that's what all mantras are supposed to do, actually. So gate gate paragate parasam gate bodhisoha gate means gone beyond, completely gone. There's commentaries on the meaning of that. So one is in the Mahayana, there's the different paths, graded paths on the journey to awakening. So basically, the first gate is the path of accumulation, the second gate is the path of preparation, the third paragate, gone beyond, refers to the path of seeing. This third path in the description in the Mahayana teachings is when there is that breakthrough. That's the bodhisattva realization of the first stage. And at that point, true emptiness is realized. For us as practitioners, we're 99.9% of us have the facsimile of that. We're studying it, we're learning it, we're getting a glimpses and a taste of it, but we still carry a mental image of our mental construct. As we rest in our meditation, we might get more and more. It's a refinement process. The whole Dharma path is said to be refining, refining, refining. And then by the time that paragate comes, it's the mental image of emptiness, or the one one's own as the observer, and then the mental image of emptiness merge or dissolve. The mental image melts like water into water, is the analogy, one analogy given. And then one has realized the perfection of wisdom at that point. And then out of that, one starts to perceive the world as in a different way. And this is sometimes described as the play of the three kayas, Dharmakaya, Sambhogakaya, Nirmanakaya. So phenomena seen as a play of emptiness, luminosity, and unimpeded. And it's with this view that the Vajrayana teaches the practitioner to utilize when they do yidam or deity yoga practice, to have that. It's what they call the result vehicle instead of the causal vehicle. The result vehicle means you try to act like you're already enlightened by visualizing yourself as a luminous form, and you're already there. You just have to recognize it. You have to recognize it. So it's a matter of ongoing practice and so forth. So
what was the second path again?
Sometimes it's called the path of preparation, or juncture sometimes. So that was that's kind of like a graded path. Explanation, you know, when Gampopa, one of the great masters of the Kagyu lineage, is a disciple of Milarepa, it said that when he taught, that he had three different approaches to his students. And the most gifted students, they would have the pointing out instructions, what are known as the pointing out instructions. And in that case, the teacher would point out the nature of mind immediately to the student, either quite often non-verbally, just by signs and symbols, or but sometimes verbally as well. And if the student was ripe, the disciple was ripe, they would get it, just like that. And then there's different degrees of getting it. So that would be like a push and a jump. They would be so ripe that they wouldn't have to do all this training. And I think everybody has some kind of flash or glimpse now and then. But if it's authentic, then quite often it has to be nurtured. So there are some really gifted that just get enlightened right on the spot, sudden enlightenment. This is what's known as sudden enlightenment. But for them to be so ripe, it has to require a lot of preparation, either in past lives or in things they did in their earlier years, to be ripe and ready like that. So the discovery of the nature of mind, or sometimes called Rigpa in Nyingma, is a genuine understanding And then from that period on, they know what they're working with. So whenever they do their meditation, they know exactly what needs to be nurtured or recognized, cultivated. There's no doubts whatsoever anymore. Those are the most gifted. So then the second style of teaching that he had was called the Six Yogas of Naropa. And those were special methods that are unique to Vajrayana, where you work with energies, the energies of the body, doing all sorts of various exercises and breathing exercises and working with the winds and the channels and the, so forth. And then the third most common type was to teach the graded path, of Lamrim. They call Lamrim in Tibetan. So you start from basically learning about impermanence, the Four Noble Truths, cause and effect, the precious human existence. And then proceed from there with practices like calm abiding, vipassana, the mind training practices which expand loving kindness and compassion, as well as the special practices of the Vajrayana, special preliminary practices which are very skillful in removing obstacles and gathering positive conditions to ripen oneself to be ready for the pointing out instructions. Pointing out instructions can happen even when the teacher's not present. So, for example, in the special preliminaries, there's the act of prostration, the physical act of doing prostrations, which is a total, like a surrendering kind of exercise. It has great benefits. It opens up the channels, deepens one's understanding of refuge, and purifies physical negativity. And then you have the purification practice of Bodhisattva, which is a particular practice that is said to be insurpassable for purifying karma that we are carrying, which we all carry, and we have no idea what we're carrying, actually. It could be from even, according to the Buddhism, from past lives. It hasn't ripened yet. So the precious human existence is an opportunity to clean the slate. It's a temporary place where we can totally clean the slate through these practices such as these. So if that helps to remove veils, lift veils. And then there's the practice of mandala offering, where we basically, it's a skillful way using the creative imagination of the mind to take generosity to the extreme. And in so doing, we gather the accumulations of merit and awareness. It's like tilling the soil, making it totally fertile in our mind stream. So we offer the universe and all that we can imagine, including our own possessions, our bodies, things we don't possess, everything beautiful we just visualize and imagine that we offer it again and again and again and again. And then that leads to the final fourth special preliminary called Guru Yoga. In this case, it means uniting your mind with the Guru, merging of the minds. So it's not just the personality of the guru, but what the guru represents, in this case, innate wakefulness, which is inherited through the ages, through the lineage, through the transmission. So you also imagine the entire heritage descending upon you. Having done mandala practice, ideally we are an open vessel at that point, and we are ripe and ready. And the Guru Yoga is another way of saying receiving the pointing out instructions. When we receive the pointing out instructions, ideally there's the merging of the mind. And then the true innate wakefulness, primordial wisdom, Buddha nature becomes fully manifest. And all of the practices in Vajrayana, which are so vast and complicated, are all geared toward that same purpose. You know, the empowerments, the elaborate empowerments ceremonies, that's a formalized version of pointing out instructions, pointing out the nature of mind. So just like we said at the beginning, that all the Dharma has a single purpose, to remove self-fixation, ego clinging. That's what's holding us back from seeing the nature of mind, of Rigpa. And so also with Tara practice, or any type of Yidam practice, the same meaning, same purpose, only it's unfortunate because at many Dharma centers in the West, I don't know about the East particularly, we're told that we should come and do Chenrezig practice, do Tara practice. And it starts to become sometimes like going to church on Sunday. And that's because if that's the case, then it means that we're not fully understanding the point there. And also there has to be a taste of an experiential taste of Shine that goes with any practice to make it wonderful.
So Tara is a Yidam. What's a Yidam?
A Yidam is when we do Tara practice, we invoke Tara first as the embodiment of enlightened activity and compassion and wisdom and so forth, as an emanation of Prajnaparamita. So the Yidam is the enlightened nature of one's own being. That is already present.
Symbolically.
Sure, symbolically. Archetypally. How do you say that? Archetypically.
Archetypically.
So there's the bit that gets to the point of relative and the absolute. So from the absolute point of view, Tara is your own innate wakefulness. Relative point of view, there's different interpretations. Tara represents, something. Tara represents, she has her story. She has her own narrative. She's said to be the earliest known feminist. There's a famous quote that Tara gave to this book that goes, supposedly it goes back tens of thousands of years. This is before the Buddha, back in previous Buddhas, where someone said, yeah, you should she was taking the Bodhisattva vow and the monk, she wanted to take vows for her practice, and a monk came up to her and said, yeah, you should practice well, and you know, in the future life you can be born a monk, and then you can go all the way. And I don't know the exact quote, but she said, you know, dividing up your dualistic mind, dividing up men and women, and this and that, and good and bad, et cetera, is only the result of a twisted mind. Something like that. She just really got. So she represents, on one hand, the feminine principle of complete openness and emptiness. And that's why is regarded as the mother of all Buddhas. So to become awake, to become enlightened, one has to realize that open-ended, spacious emptiness of no self. So then that's symbolized by Prajnaparamita, and Prajnaparamita is sometimes depicted as a woman, right? Or a deity, a feminine deity, golden color. And then from that symbol emanates other forms. It's like, I mean, if it's just nothing but inexpressible, no symbols or signs or forms or anything at all, it becomes intangible and too abstract. So there, for there to be communication to take place, we rely on manifestation, right? So, anyway. Whenever we do a Yidam deity practice, we regard the Yidam as that expression of the unity of emptiness and appearance, or emptiness and clarity, and also as the embodiment of your teachers and the lineage.
Were you done with the Heart Sutra?
Yeah, I guess I am, or sort of.
Because,
oh, anyway.
I mean, you got to the breakthrough with the gone, gone, gone beyond.
Yeah.
But then we get to the completely gone, and then the Bodhisvaha, so.
Yeah, Bodhi means enlightened or awakened, and Soha means like thus it is, or amen.
So it's an exclamation of
yeah
enlightenment.
Right.
Okay.
Right. So anytime you do a mantra and you don't practice, it's the same fundamental meaning. When you do practices like Tara or Chenrezig, and you visualize Tara in front, everything's luminous and shimmering. There's no solidity at all. So it's taught that the fixation that we normally have on everything being solid and real starts to break down. So we don't have to use analytical meditation. In doing, actually, if you do Vajrayana practices properly, like the Yams and visualize Tara, we don't have to do a lot of analyzing like they do in the Buddhist philosophy, where you break down, like a scientist, particles, subatomic particles, to prove that there's no existence there and therefore we shouldn't be grasping onto it. It's like a more of an intuitive approach. You see everything as rainbow-like and shimmering, luminous, transparent, including your own body. And so automatically the self-grasping starts to loosen up and everything becomes more porous and vibrating. And so it's like, it's called a result vehicle because you're working with seeing things the way a Buddha would see things. You are already awake and everything's just the play of enlightened mind. When they say play, it means that things just spontaneously arise naturally, empty, luminous, and unimpeded. And that's how we take that approach to our mind as well. The thoughts that come up are no longer regarded as problematic. They're the play of wisdom mind. Just like the waves on the water and so forth. So when you're saying the mantra, for example, you get to the point where you do the mantra. Up until to the mantra, we're setting up the visualizations and we imagine, like, for example, offerings coming out of our heart, rays of light. This is considered a very creative, skillful way to generate a lot of wholesome karma and so forth. And then finally it leads up to the mantra. And then as you do the mantra, there's a whole variety of options. But basically, they're all ways to sustain that sacred outlook of awareness and emptiness, form and emptiness, luminosity and emptiness, joy and emptiness. And then also to have rays of light go out in all directions from your heart, for example, that assist all sentient beings or remove all the suffering and plight of all sentient beings in the universe. So ideally when this is happening, it's not just an intellectual exercise, but there's, if you focus on your heart chakra, there's actually something, some energy that builds up there and it has an effect on your own body, a beneficial effect, healthy as well. So it's definitely not just a head trip. If it's a head trip, then we have to make some adjustments. And so also when we're doing that, it's that same awareness that there's no there. And then finally, depending on the practice you're doing, but in most practices in the Vajrayana, you will do a dissolution. Up until this point, it's called the creation phase. They have creation and completion, and they call it creation and dissolution. And then you imagine everything dissolves. The entire universe dissolves into light, merges with you, you dissolve into light, you dissolve into just open emptiness. And this is another technique or special tool that allows for an experience of non-duality. We were talking about in the Prajnaparamita where at some point, the construct of emptiness dissolves. So here we're focusing on this little sphere of light, and it's our consciousness, and then finally that sphere of light dissipates, and then you rest the mind, and then you come out. You arise as a transparent rainbow body. That's what we're advised. Don't arise as your own flesh and blood, but we, you know, we try to imagine ourselves as a luminous form. And then to our best of our ability, we try to sustain that. Of course, it's a lot easier in retreat. And then dedicate the merit. That's the conclusion of the practice. Proper beginning, proper middle, proper end. We do a dedication prayer. And then it's a complete practice. So, anyway, Tara said to be also a good practice to that removes the fear. It removes fear. Any type of fear. There are special qualities of particular practices. The Tibetans relied a lot on Tara. There's a story of, speaking of pointing out instructions, is, and that it can be done in any in different ways. Has anyone heard of Garchen Rinpoche? He's Drikun Kagyu Lama. He's getting quite well known. They have a DVD out of his life story. But what's unique about his story is he was a young man and he was a tolku. He got all the proper training of a tolku in old Tibet, and then the Chinese came, and he joined the Tibetan resistance and got captured and in prison. He was in prison for like many, many years, 20 years, I think, and went through all that hardship, was tortured. But he met a Dzogchen master in prison named Kempo Munso, and was able to get secret teachings at night and other times of the day when the guards weren't looking. And he got the pointing out instructions in prison, and it basically that's where he really got it. And he wasn't the only one. This Dzogchen master Kempo Munso gave a lot of secret teachings in prison. A lot of lamas and monks really had deep experiences and realizations in prison. Interesting. Anyway, thanks for
does anybody have any questions? We've got some time. I was going to ask about the different Taras and whether there's a very firm idea of this Tara is good for protection and this one's good for awakening.
You know, there are variety of Tara.
Colors?
Yeah, all the colors of the rainbow. The 21, the 8 Taras that protect from the 8 great fears. But they all have, that's all the same essence and meaning. If you wanted to have Tara be your main practice throughout your life, then you would learn more about these other manifestations. There's also outer, inner, secret practices. If you were to do a long retreat, you would do the outer form, the inner form, and this, you know, the secret form, etc. So what we do in the Dharma centers and the monasteries is said to be the outer form. And green Tara is related to wind, you know, wind and
So there are some practices that require empowerment. Could you describe empowerment and why that's kind of integral to all this and why it's sometimes required and sometimes it's not?
Yeah, in Vajrayana, they put a great emphasis on empowerment. There are a few practices, you know, like the outer form of Chenrezig and sometimes the outer form of Dwintara, where they say it's not, you can join in, participate. But generally, empowerment's considered very important in Vajrayana. It's the to properly receive the transmission. It's like if you try to do it without, there could be some problems that arise, misunderstandings. It's kind of like being trying to be a king without having the coronation. And like I said earlier, it's a formalized version of the pointing out instructions as well. Somehow, there has to be the appearance of it coming from the outside. Because if you do it exclusively on your own, the ego gets in the way. Subtler and subtler and subtler. It's like that old expression, you know, at some point it does you. So the empowerment symbolizes that the universe is bestowing, or that all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are bestowing upon you, are giving you, or they're pouring water to ripen you. It's not like it's coming from the outside. It's not like our Buddha nature has to be implanted in us. We have, right? So, but somehow it has to be... there has to be an opening up, and that's sort of what empowerment symbolizes also. And again, it's like the merging of the minds. If we think, oh, I don't need the empowerment, then it's like, oh, I don't need refuge. I'm going to do this on my own. You know, it's like, then all of a sudden, it ain't going to work. It's like there's a closing up thing going on. You know, non-duality, to fully be realized, there has to be an opening up to the outer, and still the outer and the inner no longer. Anyway, that's my take on it, so.
So one of them was about back to emptiness. So I think I understand that part of it, the feeling about emptiness is that there's no inherent reality to anything because it's just not there. But how do we use that to help facilitate our growth in as a bodhisattva or a compassionate person? And the second question is, isn't there another side of emptiness too, like form is empty, but isn't there the other side that emptiness is form? Can you comment on that? So the first one is like how do we use our understanding of emptiness to move forward as a compassionate luminous being, and then
The
other part is about the form and emptiness being form.
Well, the first one is the more we can appreciate the meaning of the ultimate nature of things. The empty quality of things. First, it benefits ourselves, because like there'll be a more transparent or lighter touch relationship between you and between ourselves and our thoughts and our emotions, and our, so the melodrama won't be quite as intense. It's like you know, when you're watching a movie. You suspend disbelief and you get really sucked into it, and pretty soon you're Whereas the person next to you go, come on, calm down, it's just a movie. You know, it's like, yeah, that's very similar to that. And Boca Rinpoche used to use the example of Disneyland. He said, if you take a Tibetan peasant to Disneyland and show him some of the rides or some of the illusions, they'll just be terrified. And you have to say, no, no, this is just Disneyland. So you can be of, again, if it's properly assimilated, then there's going to be a natural warmth just spontaneously for others. That's the indicator, and that's how it helps. That's where bodhisattvas get their energy from. So they're like the ever ready battery, the empty. Yeah, so it's really wonderful in that respect. And also the empty quality is there's less ego invested in their helping others, right? Because there's less ego there. There's no, so they won't be on this, we sometimes say they won't be on a crusade to, you know, or have the zeal, we gotta save these people. You know, that doesn't work that way. They're just spontaneously available to be of service at any given moment. So that's the benefit of that. Mm-hmm. And then and when emptiness is formed, one way that it's been taught is that it's just a reminder that we're not talking about emptiness as an antidote or as a, ultimately, we're not talking about it as being something else. They're inseparable in and of themselves. The inseparable unity. It's not like, again, it's not like we're uniting two things, but just by the very nature, emptiness is form, emptiness is, it can be tricky. Because it's words, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, it can be tricky. Emptiness is no other than form. Form is no other than emptiness. One teacher takes that, twists it around to say that what it means is form is form, emptiness is emptiness. So in other words, like the water, the waterness of water. Water becomes water. Water doesn't become fire. It's like a direct. When phenomena is directly assimilated, it's not changed into something else. I mean, is that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's a number of good commentaries on the Heart Sutra available. One that came out recently is quite good. It's called the Heart Attack Sutra. Because the story goes that there were some people in the audience that weren't quite ready for it. So some walked out in a huff. And then some actually said had heart attacks. It shocked them so much. But yeah, there's a little humor in that book, but it's a good commentary. another book called Echoes of Voidness by Geshe Rapton is really good. It's from the Gelugpa view.
What's it called again?
Echoes of Voidness. Here they use the word voidness for emptiness. But words can be. It's always good to take everything with a grain of salt. And the Buddha said, don't rely on words, rely on the meaning.
Lost in the translation.
person often gets lost in all of the words. And then it becomes very esoteric, and it becomes very heady, and it becomes
very heady.
Hard to translate into a practice or translate into a daily living.
Exactly.
And what good is it if we can't live it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, and there's now that they're translating just volumes and volumes and volumes. But I must say that many of the translations now are much more fresh and vibrant than, you know, 20, 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But it's good to be cautious in selecting what you're going to spend your time reading. Make sure it's genuine. And it's so easy to slip into headiness.
That continues on. Don't rely on the words, rely on the meaning to men.
The four reliances. Don't rely on the teacher, rely on the teaching.
Mm-hmm.
Or don't rely on the individual, rely on the teaching. Don't rely on the, rely not, sounds better. Rely not on the words, rely on the meaning. Rely not on the meanings which need interpretation. Rely on the definitive meanings. That's a whole other the philosophers and academics have a field day with that one. And then the final one is rely not on ordinary consciousness, rely on your primordial awareness.
Mm-hmm.
So it takes it subtler and subtler.
And what's that from? No.
Those are the four reliances. It's from basic Abhidharma, I think.
Or my own inability to let go of my ego. I often get caught up in my misunderstanding of translation or my misunderstanding of practice or what I think it should be or what I should know or what I don't know, which gets me caught up in not doing the practice.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that we need to challenge ourselves to think of it as an adventure,
mm-hmm.
and that we're, the challenge is, okay, what is really meant by this? What is meant by primordial awareness? You know, what do they mean by pointing out the nature of mind? Have I experienced that?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it, most likely I had a tiny flash of it, and the rest is like a construct, right? But if you had just a tiny flash, then we know that it's possible. So then we, it's interesting, if you start comparing the different teachings, at some point they start to really mesh, and you realize that it's like, they're all saying the same exact thing, you know? And then if you can just get a little tiny taste of what it means to rest the mind in the natural state,
mm-hmm.
and then the teachings say, this is the highway of all enlightened ones, the past, present, and future, then you get more inspired,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Or you experience the spaciousness.
Yeah.
Experience the possibility.
Yeah. But we have to keep at it. And make it routine.
Why?
The way we've been taught in the Mahamudra teachings, which is the nature of mind teachings, right, is to do shorter sessions more frequently.
Mm-hmm.
You definitely don't want to, you know, sit for 60 minutes and force yourself through that. No, shorter sessions more frequently, and especially the formless meditations. You know, which is non-referential, just objectless, that bare awareness meditation. You start out with, like I said, the one breath meditation, one breath session.
Yeah.
There's a gap there. You know, quite possible we can be completely non-distracted from our breath. So. and then rise, go back, maybe do a 2-minute session, 5-minute session, and keep coming back. Take a break, come back, depending on how much time you have. That's definitely better because it keeps it fresh. You say, if you don't want to force yourself into, and then pretty soon you look at your meditation cushion with anger. it just makes you want to throw up. No, you want to be attracted to the cushion. Yeah, so if you were lucky enough, to have a weekend retreat, for example, then you can just do shorter sessions and come back, keep it fresh, and you'll notice that the gap of non-distraction gets wider and wider. It becomes more obvious if you allow yourself more than just one session. And you say, oh, maybe there's hope left for me. Of course, the teachings say, free of hope and fear.
And speaking of retreats, are you going to have your one day or partial day in Eugene coming up?
I'm not sure of the schedule in Eugene yet. Lama Sonic Singh is due to arrive soon. But we will have our summer retreat, I think. Soon we'll know. But if you're doing like a Chenri Z practice or other Vajrayana practice, there's such a variety of options within the practice itself that you can remain entertained for a longer period. You could do an hour and a half, 2-hour session because you're doing different things at different times.
Do you have a recommendation for somebody who wants to have a description of all the objects of meditation and ways of, remedies for dullness and over excitedness and all those kinds of things? Is there one that you?
Yeah, there's there's a good book by Trungpa Rinpoche called any of his Mahamudra books. Are really good for that. Trungpa Rinpoche is real reliable, he will introduce a number of techniques. That's the first person that comes to my mind. Yeah.
He's still alive, right? Where does he live?
I think he lives mainly in Nepal, but he used to travel a lot.
Yeah.
Right.
So are we there?
Yeah.
Okay, well, I'd like to thank Lama Sonam and Lama Yangchen for coming up on a now rainy evening. And we hope to have you back whenever you're able.
Thank you.
And thank you so
thanks
much.
Thanks for listening. Thanks for your patience and so forth.
Thank you.
I'll say my little dedication first.
Oh, great.
Sonam li tamje zingpani tome ni pedra nam panche ne kega na chi balo trupai si pe sole. Thank you.
Thank you.
Same as hallelujah.
And if anybody wants to know about our group, our website's written on the back little poster back there where the Donna basket is. We're Droma Sump and Tulane, and we used to be called the Corvallis Dharma Group or Dharma Study Group. And we've been here for a long time, and we meet Monday evenings now. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.